Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Wednesday, April the 30th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing. We still don't have a quorum, so as the subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5541, the Real Estate Agency. After the gavel, we'll be open. Scratch one back out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Please excuse me for being late. I was on a radio program, and I did everything I could to drive legally and get here. He was off. He said, you can make it there in 30 minutes. It takes 47 minutes.
Senator, the only thing I could say to that is you said at least you did it legally, and generally when I'm on the freeway, I'm not doing it legally. So.
Well, I had a couple of school buses, too, that were apparently late this morning. That helped to slow us down a little bit.
Morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I am the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. With your permission, what I'd like to do is pick up where I left off yesterday, and then I'll address the concerns that were raised when I'm completed.
Very good.
If that suits you.
That would be great.
Okay. I was about to begin to talk about our performance measures, and before I do, I'd just like to say that in our 2001-2003 budget, we reported 9 performance measures and maintained 19 measures internally. I have to tell you that since I've been at the agency, beginning in mid-1995, I've had a hard time figuring out what some of those performance measures really meant and how they applied to what it was that we did. We worked with the Progress Board in revising those measures, and the number was reduced to 4 performance measures in the 03-05 budget, and we have 2 others that we use internally, and I'll discuss those later in my response. The goals and performance measures are, the first goal is to provide quality protection for Oregon consumers of real estate-related services. Strategies for achieving the goal include education and licensure of professionals, investigation of complaints and compliance audits with real estate offices. Performance measure of that activity is the ratio of offices audited per biennium to the total number of offices. The second goal is to regulate in a manner that supports a positive real estate market. Strategy for achieving that goal is to collaboratively review statutes and administrative rules. Performance measure is to collaboratively complete new legislative concepts and administrative rules during the biennium. This is a challenge. That when you're a professional licensing regulatory body, there's a challenge there. One, the regulation that you do, you want to do sufficient to protect the public, but you also don't want to regulate so heavily that it actually interrupts the flow of business and makes it impossible for folks to perform that business, and therefore we think it's very important that we work collaboratively with the affected industries, and we work very hard to do that. The third goal is to provide excellent customer service. One strategy for achieving that goal is to get feedback on how well the licensure process serves its customers, and an outcome is the percentage of customers who rates the agency's service positively. We've historically collected that data by submitting a questionnaire. Performance measure is percentage of license and examination survey respondents who rate the agency positively. Target of 97% is sought for 2005, which is an improvement over the average of 96% for the 4 quarters of 2000. Another strategy for achieving the goal of excellent consumer services is to respond quickly to consumer complaints. The measure of achievement for that goal is the average number of days to close a formal complaint. The agency has historically collected that data, and a target of 130 days is sought for 2005, which is a decrease from the 141 average number of days for 2000. And I'll elaborate on that in my response. a complete list of those measures, sources, and the progress board committee comments are included in your Appendix 1. Long term, the agency will advance its mission to provide quality protection for Oregon consumers of real estate, escrow, and land development services, balanced with a professional environment conducive to a healthy real estate market. The agency will do so by fully implementing the changes to laws and rules resulting from Senate Bill 446, most of which will increase the professionalism of licensees. The agency will also actively monitor the rapidly changing technology and structure to assure that statutes and administrative rules are sufficiently relevant in a changing business environment to provide for both protection of the consumer and the profession's ability to function. Short-term activities of the agency will also focus on implementation of Senate Bill 446, including assurance that required real estate office policies are adopted and that additional educational requirements are completed. Agency will continue to focus on service to the public, licensees, and other public agencies toward reduced enforcement problems in property management, real estate, and escrow programs where billions of dollars are handled annually, and will expand license reciprocity to include most licensing jurisdictions. I might add one suggestion that was mentioned to us recently. The Arizona Association of Realtors and the Arizona Real Estate Commission have entered into a joint venture to provide on both of their websites a public information question and answer on how you do a real estate transaction, how you get a real estate professional, that sort of thing. We intend to embark on a very similar project here in Oregon. Our revenue source is entirely other funds derived from licensing, registration, auditing, examinations, publications, seminars, and other services. Total agency budget has increased by slightly more than 6% per biennium in the last 10 years, from $4.9 million in fiscal year 95-97 to the current governor's balanced budget for years 03-05 is $6.3 million, which excludes two policy packages totaling $312,600. After a major expansion and contraction in the 1980s related to land development legislation and a recession, the agency's programs and expenditures have remained relatively stable. The majority of the budgetary increases in the past 10 years occurred as a result of inflation factors for supplies and services and some increases in the other payroll expenses. Number of personnel for the agency has remained relatively stable. The number of licensees appears to have stabilized since August of 2001, and it is expected that the revenues will remain also stable. Some incidental costs in the 2000-2003 biennium were required to implement Senate Bill 446, but there have been no major program changes. As reported to the JLCIMT in 2002, an office automation project initiated in 1995 has resulted in efficiencies and economies. My testimony is at Appendix 2. When we accomplished this, just to give you an idea of what we did two things. One, we migrated our licensing database off the state mainframe. And the second thing we did is we migrated our internal operations from an old Wang mini computer system. To give you an idea of what that system was like, when I came out of private sector, I was used to working in a Windows-based environment. I walked into the Wang system, and it took me back to somewhere around DOS 1.0. Primitive, I think, is the best thing I can say about it.
Just a little bit short of punch cards, right?
Mr. Chair, I think you're exactly correct.
Any shads.
Yeah, any shads.
God forbid we have any of those. Office automation, both software and hardware, improve the speed and accuracy with which employees can complete their work. For example, preparation of investigative reports is improved by the ability to access information from various databases. The agency can maintain its own website and offer courses online. and in-house production of agency publications is possible through desktop publishing. The integrated relational database serves the agency's business needs much better. With the integration of systems, many more easy-to-use reports are available, statistical analyses and counts are automated, much more information is captured, and complaint and licensing data is integrated. Automation has simplified the licensing process and reduced workload overall. For example, automation of examination scheduling and results has greatly reduced that workload, and with barcoding of renewal and new license applications, processing time is further reduced. With a local area network and the ability to maintain the code table in-house, problems can be resolved more quickly. Other efforts at cost containment are contractors or temporary employees are used for projects or increased workload, reducing long-term expenditures while fulfilling our workload demands. The agency has produced educational materials in-house. The agency designs and maintains its website in-house. The agency will use DAP's remote access service and eliminate dedicated phone lines, modems, and long distance in the next biennium. The agency changed its mainframe connection, as I mentioned, from an open connect to a direct internet protocol. The agency made additional budget reductions recommended by the governor's office, including elimination of color copies. Our news journal, distributed quarterly to approximately 20,000 licensees, has been printed for nearly 30 years, and blue ink is now printed in black. We cooperate with other governmental agencies and organizations with which we share a community of interest. These agencies, the activities create efficiencies, avoid duplication, and or minimize costs. Estimating administrative costs is difficult because the agency has a single budget structure that includes all of the agency's activities, so there is no separation in the budget of costs related to licensing, regulation, education, land development, information systems, or administration. Also, as a regulatory body, the services we deliver are difficult to quantify. Our emphasis is on prevention and compliance, and it's difficult to measure how many times a problem is prevented. As a result, at the request of LFO, the agency sent a list of services organized into four priorities, and I think you'll find them at the back of that particular handout. We estimated the budget for each by using personal services costs of the four and then dividing the total services and supplies costs by the same percentages. In estimating the administrative cost ratios, we used the same four areas. Administrative costs were determined to be the personal services costs related to the commissioner's office, the information systems section, and the administrative services section. These personnel costs represent 28.83% of the total personnel services expenditures. Related services and supplies expenditures were estimated by using that same ratio. Again, the estimates are very rough and are probably high because the budget is a single interrelated structure. Administrative costs versus delivery of services is nearly impossible to separate. Our managers are working managers with a large range of program delivery responsibilities. For example, costs included in the overall costs related to the commissioner and staff, deputy commissioner, administrative services manager staff, and information services systems managers and staff. However, up to 75% of my time is spent in the delivery of regulatory and educational services. 40 to 50% of the time, the deputy is spent in delivery of education and licensing services, and so on. Therefore, it's extremely difficult for us to quantify that. Our essential packages are largely technical adjustments. The first is a $30,000 adjustment needed to bring the base budget to the current service level based on an estimate of retirement-related salary savings. The second adjustment of $22,800 is based on monthly Visa MasterCard merchant fees averaging $950 a month. The third makes adjustments for DAS's published list of inflation and price adjustments. Goods and services increases of $118,059 and government service charge increases of $23,637. We do have two policy packages. Package 101 is our information technology upgrades. I mentioned it's an integrated system.
So let me back you up for a second.
Certainly.
These Visa, MasterCard, these are charges because of money that you're collecting via the, over the Internet for classes that are being taken, or are these actual expenditures that you're running using Visa, MasterCard?
Mr. Chairman, those charges are expenses that we incur using Visa and MasterCard. My recollection is, and I'm sure my deputy will hit me over the head if I'm wrong, is that last biennium's budget, we did not include those because we just began using credit card services in the last biennium.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Adam Torgerson with the Department of Administrative Services. There was a change overall in the state. In the past, those were reductions to revenue, so they would just count less revenue coming in. And an accounting change this year, all of the agencies will now have to record them as an expense.
Purpose of Package 101 is to enhance the overall functionality of the agency's software, which integrates licensing, complaint tracking, exam, and remittance processing applications. The components are to enhance the licensing and complaint management system by adding or modifying needed reports, fields, code tables, bitmaps, screens, windows, and icons, and providing Internet-based training. To add Internet functionality by building the capability for online processing of licensing and renewal applications and online audit of the percentage of users. During the 0103 biennium, the agency's website posted information regarding all agency services, including education, exams, licensing, and complaint forms, and online continuing ed. That is a work in progress. One thing I'd like to add there is... being the competitive type of person that I am, it disturbs me that my agency at this point does not have the technology to do online licensing renewal when I look around the country and see other real estate licensing agencies that have been able to do that for years. We also intend to enhance the network by upgrading the desktop and operating system software, improving our remote access functionality, building a server lab, and adding network tools. Majority of this package relates to software enhancements by the development of our system. We'll work with DAS to ensure the developers' upgrades are integrated into the new statewide Internet system. Those expenditures are $235,822. Package 102 relates to exam services. The agency currently administers exams monthly at statewide sites. The purpose of the package, again, is to bring us competitive with other states, is to permit examination of license applications on demand in a secure computer-based environment. Policy package will be accomplished by using a request for proposal to exam service providers. We'll compare those proposals to the cost of administering exams from a secure agency server via community college test centers, and we'll implement the most cost-effective option. The expected results are improved service to license applicants by increasing the frequency of when they can take an exam and reducing the waiting period for exam results, which are currently about 6 days. Both can be measured from the examination data. Part-time exam supervisors and proctors would be eliminated. The agency's current examination fee is $75. Community colleges would charge the agency $20 per applicant to administer the exam. And exam fee revenues, which are other funds, would be reduced by an estimated $106,360. The one-time cost of $30,000 for hardware and software will be covered with carryover balance of other funds. In our last budget hearing, the subcommittee had some comments, and I'd like to respond to those briefly for just a moment. They had three concerns. There was a concern about high legal expenditures in general and relative to hearings. In fact, as I recall, our hearing officer budget was unscheduled and attached as a separate item and only used as it was needed. Subcommittee asked the agency to report to the appropriate committee during the interim on its actual allocation of legal and hearing fees and gatekeeping measures to control fees and utilization of overall legal and hearing staff. We provided information to the Legislative Fiscal Office staff in completing a review of the hearing officers panel for the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. The review included analysis of budget issues. The agency has monitored its hearing expenditures, and expenditure information was also provided at the request of Senator Jackie Winters. The review was published, and legislative fiscal staff advised the agency that no further information was required. There was discussion about our workload and efficiency savings relative to our information systems improvements. Subcommittee requested the agency report its migration information system project to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology during the interim. We submitted that report that I alluded to as Appendix 2. The committee accepted the report with positive comments, and no further information was requested. Policy Package 101 would complement this migration. The package would enhance the overall functionality of our integrated licensure software and would permit the use of internet for processing transactions. Final comment by the subcommittee was a concern about exchange accommodators that operate as subsidiaries of title and escrow companies. While there are no known losses to consumers in Oregon as a result of accommodator's actions, the agency did report that there is an additional public risk because of unscrupulous or incompetent practitioners. One state regulates, that's Nevada, regulates by means of registration and conducts criminal background checks. As far as I know, they're the only state that does anything relative to exchange accommodators. Subcommittee requested the agency provide a report to the appropriate legislative committee during the interim. We reviewed the issue during the interim. An accommodator substitutes for an exchangeor in IRS Section 1031 tax-deferred exchanges, and under IRS regulation, an accommodator is an independent person. The accommodator prepares the exchange agreement, which establishes a trust account in which the exchange funds are held. While accommodators of independence create some risk, most investors engaging in such transactions are sophisticated, and the use of services of professionals, for example, accountants, attorneys, or both. An informal survey indicated by the agency, as I mentioned, no other states regulate accommodators. Based on past discussions with Representative Butler and a later discussion with the LFO analyst, the agency did not identify any further action required. Affirmative action. Our affirmative action plan is attached to Appendix 3. We employ 30.66 full-time equivalents, and a summary of our affirmative action is upper management, which is 31 plus on the state scale. Of the six upper management positions, two positions are female. There is one minority employee and one disabled employee. Middle management, both of the individuals employed in this group are female. Professional, 7 of the 14 in this group are female. Administrative specialists and support, 7 of 7 are female.
Chair George.
Thank you. When you look at the affirmative action numbers, it hits me that that in some of the categories that males aren't represented accordingly. Just an observation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith,
You've been too successful.
One thing I think I would say, though, is if you look at the real estate industry as a whole, I think you'll find that our demographics mirror the industry. In fact, that industry, probably the most successful people in it, with the exception of some commercial practitioners, happen to be female.
Just an observation.
Thank you,
Chair.
Long-range strategies to achieve parity are to continue to network with advocacy organization and educators. To fulfill ADA requirements, the agency regularly conducts ergonomic analyses and makes changes. The agency modified its restrooms and installed braille signs. The agency has TTY services available and makes special arrangements to accommodate the needs of customers. For example, we have used readers. We've used interpreters. And one particular case that I can think of where we had an individual who had a head injury and had no short-term memory, we accommodated that individual in her exam process by allowing the use of a personal laptop computer. The agency continues to promote a discrimination-free workplace and to make work environment hospitable to persons of diverse backgrounds, and to assist employees in upward mobility through retention and career development efforts. That would conclude my budget portion, and I would entertain any questions should you so have them.
Any questions for Commissioner Taylor? Senator Morris.
What the function of land development, what does that entail?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, the Land Development Department, in essence, governs, administers what is left of ORS 92 as well as some sections of ORS 100. Specifically, that deals primarily with condominiums, timeshare developments, and some allied type of issues, real estate marketing organizations and the like.
Would you like to go ahead with the response at this time?
Would that yes, I would.
Your desire? Okay.
Yesterday, you were provided testimony by Emily Seerleaf, the executive director of the Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon. Her testimony makes serious allegations about the agency, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to respond. I'll begin by reassuring the committee that the agency takes its mission seriously. We license over 19,000 real estate professionals, and in the past year, we issued 180 administrative orders imposing some sort of sanction on licensees. In the past decade, between 1993 and 2002, those numbers averaged 185 per year. We take our preventative role seriously as well. And in the past biennium, distributed over 160,000 copies of the educational Oregon Real Estate News Journal, distributed countless brochures, online courses, videos, and provided license law updates and training sessions to thousands of licensees. I'd like to respond to statements directly from Ms. Seerleaf's testimony. Her first remark was one remark was several years back the real estate licensees did not want the deputy commissioner to become the commissioner when a vacancy would occur and introduced a legislative bill to require the commissioner to have a real estate license, the only qualification he lacked. It has become apparent to many with a real estate license that this connection has become a liability. I've been involved in the real estate industry since 1976. To my recollection, every commissioner since 1976 has possessed a real estate license. Oregon Laws 1981, Chapter 617, Section 17, established the real estate board much as it currently exists, though with only seven members. It removed the commissioner as a member of the board and required that the commissioner have been a real estate licensee for 5 years. It was the first time the law required that the commissioner must be a real estate licensee. Prior to that, it was a 7-member board, one of which was the commissioner, who could have also been from the administrative staff. Oregon Law's 1987, Chapter 414, Section 38, added the language to the statute that allowed a person actively involved in the agency for a year could be a candidate for commissioner. The law was in effect when I became commissioner in 1995, and in fact, one of the deputies at the time was a candidate. In fact, he was a finalist for the position. The provision was deleted in Senate Bill 446 by the legislature and once again requires that the commissioner have been actively licensed for 5 years prior to his or her appointment. Oregon is one of 3 states where boards are advisory and the real estate commissioner serves as the full-time administrator of the agency. Because it is a policy-setting agency and because the commissioner is the ultimate decision-maker in administrative orders, knowledge of the profession is a significant prerequisite. In states where the commission has policy-making authority, the commission is the ultimate decision-maker in administrative orders, and in many states serves as the hearing panel. In every state where this system is in place, a supermajority of the commission are active real estate licensees. Ms. Cedarleaf, there are 4 associations within the state whose membership includes real estate licensees. She mentioned the Oregon Association of Realtors, her organization, the Rental Housing Association, and the Metro Multifamily Housing Association. She admitted 2 significant organizations with an interest in property managers, Building Owners and Managers Association, BOMA, representing primarily commercial property managers and owners, and the Institute of Real Estate Management, IREM, representing both small and larger residential property managers as well as some commercial property managers. Ms. Cedarleaf, ORF 696015 identifies the mission statement of the agency as follows. What happened to fiduciary standards without customer response, then why have an agency? ORF 696015 is titled Legislative Finding, short title. The agency developed its mission statement with those findings in mind. We believe it's a good faith reflection of the findings, and apparently the governor, DAS, and the legislature agree, as it has been included as part of the agency's legislative adopted budget since at least 1989. More importantly, the agency organization procedures and operations reflect the highest emphasis on client trust accounting and fiduciary responsibilities to protect the Oregon consumer. Ms. Cedarleaf, the commissioner is a member of a national organization called NARELO, the National Association of Real Estate Licensing Organizations. He has been elected president-elect, and it appears that all of the travel and expenses are being paid from the agency budget. The Association of Real Estate License Law Officials, ARELO, is an international organization of public real estate regulatory officials whose mission is to support jurisdictions in the administration and enforcement of real estate license laws to protect and promote the public interest. The Real Estate Board is on record as encouraging my active participation in this important body of regulatory policy officials. While I could elaborate at length on how this organization benefits Oregon, I will state that it maintains an administrative action database for its members where if a person is sanctioned in one jurisdiction, that information is available to other jurisdictions. The organization also maintains a licensee database where a member of the public or a regulator can go to one place to find where an individual is licensed. This database is not complete at this time, as some jurisdictions are still working at getting their data to the database. However, there are over 2 million licensees on this database in all 50 states and the District of Columbus. The database will eventually be able to give consumers much more information about licensees than it currently does. Please note that in the current biennium, agency out of travel was limited to 3 persons, and our total expenditures are just over $10,000. Of that total, several of the trips were reimbursed, further reducing our expenditures. For example, our land development manager is required to travel to approve certain developments doing business in Oregon, and his expenses are reimbursed. Likewise, as Arello president-elect, Arello pays my travel expenses for meetings my position requires that I would not otherwise attend as Oregon commissioner. As president, Arello will pay for all of my travel expenditures related to the cost of my travel, and a reduction in actual out-of-state travel expenditures for 2003 to 05 is likely. As an aside, this group coincidentally meets this October in Portland, where I'll be installed as president, assuming I'm still the real estate commissioner. Regardless, the association will be in Portland this fall and brings tourist dollars to this state. I might add that this will be a good showcase for Oregon. You'll have people attending from Canada, the various jurisdictions, several jurisdictions in Africa, several Pacific Rim jurisdictions, most of the populated jurisdictions of Australia, and others. Recently, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled against the agency license revocation. Instead of coming back to the legislative body with statutory corrections, the agency response is to do less and not raise any waves. The Dearborn case is a case involving a real estate broker who was an admitted crack cocaine and methamphetamine user, as well as admitted to providing drugs in exchange for sex in at least one case with a minor. The agency suspended Mr. Dearborn's license for an indeterminate time. The agency is gravely concerned about the case where the commissioner's order was reversed by the Supreme Court. If the committee wishes, I can elaborate on the legal issues. This case led to another case before the Supreme Court, Curley versus the Real Estate Agency, where we believe the Court of Appeals erroneously applied Dearborn. The agency has aggressively sought a legislative remedy, which is embodied in Senate Bill 206. The AA engrossed version of this bill, the remedy is a modification of ORS 696-022, sub 5, sub A, an amendment to ORS 696-301, there's a typo there, sub 26, which removes the word substantial from the statute, which appears to be the appellate court's concern in Dearborn, and an amendment to ORS 696-301, sub 31, which more clearly brings in activities occurring outside an individual's real estate activity, which we believe addresses both Dearborn and Curley should the Supreme Court uphold the Court of Appeals in that case. This bill is passed out of committee and with a due pass recommendation. In addition, Senate Bill 893 provides a general legislative remedy to ORS 670, adding 670-280 sub 3. I'm not aware that this bill has been heard yet. The agency has actively participated with the Department of Justice in proposing this remedy. Ms. Cedarleaf has demonstrated to me a lack of understanding of the issue. In the April edition of her publication, Hot News, she referred to an administrative rule regarding criminal background check. The following is the text of an email correspondence I sent to her on April 15th. To date, I have received no response. Emily. On page 4 of the above publication, under In Case You Missed This and More Additional Information Update, you refer to a former administrative rule allegedly giving the real estate authority agency the authority to require a criminal-free background check. You're in error. I refer you to statute ORS 696-022 sub 5 sub A, which states in relevant part, a license shall be granted only to a person who is trustworthy. As a condition of licensing, the commissioner may require such proof of trustworthiness as the commissioner deems necessary, and B, which states in relevant part, in implementing this subsection, the commissioner may require fingerprints. The authorization is in statute, not in rule, and has been in statute as long as I've been commissioner. If you'll turn to OAR 863-015-0015, application, background check application, and fingerprint cards, You'll note the application requires submission of fingerprints and declarations about an applicant's criminal past. We still consider an applicant's criminal history as we have in the past while working under the restraints of Dearborn and more recently Curley, which fortunately the Supreme Court has granted our petition for review and which applies more to pre-licensing than we believe Dearborn does. In fact, we believe this case is a misapplication of Dearborn. However, the statute does not now, nor has it, or the rule in the past, required a criminal-free background check. Further, any implication that a criminal past can be the sole reason for denial of an occupational or professional license is prohibited by statute. And I'd refer you again to RS 670 sub 280. This agency has in the past and continues to review criminal histories and evaluates them relative to the statutory requirement that an application must be trustworthy and competent within the constraints of the applicable appellate court cases in ORS 670-280. Since Dearborn, we have denied licenses because of criminal history, including one by administrative hearing, where the hearing officer agreed with the agency that the applicant's criminal history was substantially related to her trustworthiness and competence to hold the license. Please correct your publication accordingly without delay. Thank you. Additionally, the real estate agency proposed in Senate Bill 206 the implementation of a trust account overdraft program, essentially monitoring the one used by the Oregon State Bar. This amendment, was intended to provide the agency with early warning when a licensee's client trust account overdraws. Property managers use clients' trust accounts in managing their properties. These are the source of funds that are stolen from consumers. Ms. Cedarleaf did not appear to testify in this bill. This portion of the bill was amended out to move the bill. Interestingly, though I am informed some individual licensees oppose this, OAR did not testify against it. The agency also proposed Senate Bill 208, which would have established a bonding provision for those engaged in property management. The bill died in committee. Repeatedly, Ms. Cedarleaf again, the commissioner has identified that any complaint in which an investigation indicated that revocation would be appropriate will automatically be reduced to a reprimand to save the agency attorney fees that the Supreme Court action cost. This statement is a complete fabrication. I never made the statement. In fact, the agency has refused to issue licenses to several applicants because of criminal history, including the one I mentioned previously, post-Dearborn. I might add that the case Ms. Cedarleaf refers to also ended in a revoked license post-Dearborn. I've searched my memory to think of where this could have been taken in or out of context, and I have to tell you, I haven't a clue. The agency reported to the, Ms. Cedarleaf again, the agency reported to eBoard that the conversion of their computer system went well and should stand as a model for other agencies. I experienced numerous problems with the database, and in questioning the commissioner, he admitted that we were going to have to start all over. It appears this is being spread over several budget cycles in order not to bring attention to the problem. Again, her statement is a fabrication. I never made such a statement. Please refer to your presentation handbook, which includes my testimony before the JLCIMT. Based on legislative and direction and approval since 1996, the agency has gradually migrated off the DAS mainframe and a relational database. I've mentioned the budget enhancement. I'm pleased to learn that she experienced problems with our secure database, which is protected by a firewall and additional password protected Oracle security to prevent any unauthorized access. Though I'm being facetious, the agency provides copies of the licensing database in a CD-ROM format. However, we have no record of providing Ms. Cedarleaf with a copy. Since the commissioner now comes from within the real estate agency, he has surrounded himself with management that appears to be working towards protecting licensees rather than a consumer protection agency. I suspect that many licensees would argue this particular contention. I find that interesting that at one time we can be considered overreaching in our enforcement of the laws and at the same time being considered underreaching. Although I was employed as a broker, I was an educator and actively involved in professional standards. As president-elect of Arello, which is an association of consumer protection agencies worldwide, I have tirelessly worked towards uniformity of licensing statutes across jurisdictions and issues leading to greater consumer protection, as well as greater professionalism within the industry. When I came to this agency, I did not just suddenly develop a consumer orientation to real estate practice. As a realtor, I'd been involved in professional standards since the early 1980s and was the first certified professional standards procedure instructor in Oregon. I was also the first instructor in Oregon qualified to teach licensee risk management courses. Those courses, for your information, teach licensees how to avoid, how to conduct their practice at a level that they avoid getting complaints to regulatory bodies and getting lawsuits. Beginning in 1987 and ending with the successful legislation in 1993, I led the drive to require mandatory agency disclosure in Oregon. I've been recognized and taught nationally as an expert in agency as it applies to real estate professionals. I was also instrumental in achieving the 93 legislation establishing mandatory written seller's disclosure for residential properties. 1995, I was involved prior to my appointment in the legislation leading to increased continuing ed requirements for real estate licensees. Finally, most would agree as commissioner, I was the prime mover for the effort leading up to the passage of Senate Bill 446, to which I had previously alluded. Additionally, my background includes having attended the National Judicial College for Education as an administrative hearing officer, as well as training as a mediator. During the years that I was the administrative hearing officer for the agency, I issued approximately 75 administrative hearing orders. I can count on one hand the number of those orders that represented either a reprimand or a dismissal. The rest of them were either suspensions or revocations of licenses. I don't think I've been soft on the industry. The deputy commissioner was executive director of three different state regulatory agencies for 17 years as a career public service, holds an MS, and lacks only her dissertation for a PhD in public administration. The manager of the regulation division holds a JD, is also a career public servant with 27 years with state real estate regulatory agencies. He spent 17 years with the Texas Real Estate Commission in the same position as he now holds in Oregon. He served as their general counsel and is experienced in prosecuting real estate licensees before a hearings officer. I consider the ability to capture this individual was a one in a million chance. Also among the agency's management is another attorney, a CPA, an information technology professional, and the former licensing manager of another state of the state's child care provider programs. None of the managers are from the real estate industry, and they're all committed to the mission of the agency. The Cedarleaf. In the 01 legislative session, the agency introduced Senate Bill 446, which was negotiated with the Oregon Association of Realtors. The rewrite began after the adjournment of the 97 session and was the culmination of the work of task forces representing a cross-section of stakeholders, including licensees, educators, consumer representatives, attorneys, and so forth. I could go on and on about that bill, but I really don't want to waste your time doing that. The commissioner had one apparent goal, to have one license. However, rather than having a basic license with endorsements, the agency took the basic license categories and changed the names. Senate Bill 446 represents the first comprehensive revision of the laws in decades. The purpose of the bill is to improve pre- and post-license education of licensees and to recognize the realities of the contemporary marketplace as it relates to real estate brokerage. I might add, there are two other states that now have the same licensing principle that we embody. The first in the country was Colorado. As we speak, there are three other states that are seriously considering or have the same type of legislation on their agendas. One of those states is a rather small state known as Florida. The agency has identified that ORS 696361 is the statute under which all the property management rules have been authorized. From this one statute, all of the property management administrative rules are written. The statement is inaccurate. Ms. Cedarleaf mischaracterizes 696361. This section is found in both current law and prior law substantively unchanged. 696361 says only that under the law, a real estate property manager licensee is treated the same as any other real estate licensee. There is a broad directive rulemaking authority under ORS 696-385 sub 3. Prior to 1987, professional property management could only be done by a real estate broker. Property manager licensing laws were first passed in 1987 and Oregon laws 1987 chapter 611 sections 12 through 16 and section 20. The law created one additional type of license. Real estate property manager, a license limited to those activities. It was a time of paper and pencil accounting. The law was an attempt to provide some regulation where people without a broker's license were illegally engaging in professional property management. Prior to 2002, property management rules were scattered throughout the agency's rules, were difficult to access and difficult to understand. Senate Bill 446 does only one thing regarding property managers. It requires existing property to obtain additional approved courses before July 1, 2004, and it requires more rigorous pre-licensing courses, primarily attempted at approaching the areas where we find the property managers are primarily deficient. The rules were a result of a great deal of work by the agency and created an entire division of rules to reflect the changes in industry and technology and to offer greater fiduciary protections. These rules remain a work in progress to accommodate such changes. I mentioned yesterday that there were some rules that upon adjournment we will begin working on again. This particular section is one of them. As an industry representative, it made me uneasy that there would be no statutory guidelines, but we were assured repeatedly by the commission that a work group would be convened to create the rules. This didn't happen, and the administrative rule process has not been followed. Again, there were never statutory guidelines. The broad parameters were completed via rulemaking. The rules were created through a great deal of collaboration with several segments of the industry who expressed an interest in participating, including an OAR task force, IRM, BOMA, and the Metro Multifamily Housing Council. The same opportunity would have been afforded to Ms. Cedarleaf had she indicated she elected to participate. For example, I had an appointment scheduled with her on July 18, 2001. She did not appear for the appointment. She did not call to explain why. Considering the number of licensees affected by these rules as compared to the general real estate licensee population, more time was spent developing the property manager section of the rules than any of the other sections such as education and licensing. Care was taken to consolidate the rules into one division. We believe the current rules are easier to access and understand. We also attempted to get them to where they are easier to use with computerized property management software applications. We attempted to address the problems as we understood them to exist. These rules continue to be a work in progress. The agency's rules coordinator is an attorney, and the agency was scrupulous in filing the rules correctly. timely notice and publication and the opportunity were provided to the agency's rulemaking notice list, which includes Ms. Cedarly. Those proposed rules were sent in October. She didn't respond for 6 months. Even then, the agency met with Ms. Cedarly, heard her concerns, and I believe incorporated some of them where appropriate. Ms. Cedarly. Instead, three management staff with limited, if any, working knowledge about rental property management created the rules. The statement is incorrect. A broad range of staff were involved in drafting the rules. Two investigator auditors were involved, one of whom has past experience as a full-time property manager and spent 6 years as a real estate licensee engaged in property management. Additionally, I believe his degree is in accounting, and he has worked in the past for a CPA. The commissioner and the rules coordinator were also involved, as well as the broad coalition identified above. Ms. Cedarly, complaints made by owners should not be a numbers game. We close this many files, but a solution progress. For many years, performance measures in the agency's legislative adopted budgets have included the timely resolution of complaints, which would imply legislative and governor's staff's endorsement of such standards. Likewise, the agency worked with Progress Board in developing its current standards. A related standard within the agency is that 75% of the cases are completed 6 months after they're assigned, with 100 within 9 months. Now, I ask you, if you're a potential complainant, would you want to wait longer than 6 to 9 months to find out how your complaint was doing? As an aside, before I came to the agency, I filed a complaint as a licensee, which was still open 2 years after it had been filed, after I'd returned to the come to the agency. Within that time, and I think this will underscore the problem, two witnesses who could have proved the case died. This delay allowed a licensee who made a willful misrepresentation in selling her own property to go free, while the consumer suffered many thousands of dollars in damages. The agency does cooperate with district attorneys in the prosecution of egregious cases if the evidence is sufficient. The difficulty is that the agency's burden of proof for an administrative action against a licensee is preponderance of the evidence, and the criminal burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. Thus, the agency's focus is on revocation, getting the offending licensee out of the business as rapidly as possible as our best remedy for protecting the public in egregious cases. Ms. Cedarly, property management needs to be investigated by experienced individuals who know where to look and who understand what they see. Every one of the 12 investigators cannot be a generalist. The agency has 13 investigator auditors on staff, one having experience as a real estate property manager. Because of the breadth of the business we regulate, as well as its complexities, our investigators and auditors must be broadly trained. We simply don't know where a complaint will come from. To the best of our knowledge, property management activities apply to less than 10% of our licensees. Last summer, I personally became involved in an investigation into the activities of a broker who's had a real estate property management company. Following is a summary of this particular licensee's complaint. This is a reference to three separate real estate agency investigations encompassing four files handled by two investigators. I have to add that this particular licensee moved through several, or at least more than one company, moving files with her during this process. November 2001 letter of reprimand is, I believe, an advisory letter dated November 14, 2001, for the first investigation file when this licensee was at a previous firm. There is no such thing as a letter of reprimand. It would be an order. Chronologically, the next file ended in a stipulated reprimand dated April 29, 2002. The last two files, which had numerous references to the previous file, which ended in the agreed revocation dated October 21st, 2002. In any event, all these files were muddled together in Ms. Cedarleaf's testimony. Second file was opened pursuant to one complaint from one owner. The complaint identified the licensee as managing the property without a written contract, failure to pursue a late rent, and not forwarding all funds and information to the successor property manager. The complaint did not allege missing money, but more accurately, disputed money. The investigation focused primarily upon the specific complaint. During the investigation, the licensee admitted to several violations. Principally, in addition to admitting to the owner's specific complaint, to also not maintaining property accounting records and not performing reconciliation. The investigator gathered numerous printed copies of what was represented to be the licensee's accounting records. The licensee had a hired consultant who was present at each of the interviews and produced the records. This is the witness referred to in Ms. Cedarleaf's testimony. The investigation report noted numerous areas of noncompliance and recommended administrative action. Further, there was ongoing contact with the licensee throughout the process, advising her and her consultant that she needed to correct many of the accounting regularities and replace certain funds. This is the file that resulted in a reprimand. Sometime later, the licensee relocated her office and her files were burned. I believe the investigation and resulting in administrative action to be in keeping with our prior history in dealing with property management complaints. Since I've been with the agency, we have consistently pursued administrative action where necessary while attempting to effect licensee compliance, all in an effort to maintain a marketplace for owners. The subsequent investigation showed the licensee's inability to comply and resulted in the revocation of her license. The licensee was given due process, advisory letter, reprimand, finally, revocation. For what it's worth, last September at a Wilsonsville property management workshop, the investigator involved in the reprimand encountered the licensee's hired consultant. She agreed and confirmed that he'd told the licensee to replace the unaccounted for monies, and also confirmed that the licensee was not honest with her either. The third and fourth files involving this licensee initially involved two complaints, which were initially filed in July of 2002, and three other owners were interviewed or wrote the agency during the investigation. An unknown number of other owners, last count I heard was 20, made contact with the agency. Per the order, the licensee agreed to the revocation of her broker license effective October 21, 2002. The order found a negative balance in the CTAs of some $32,000 as determined by a statement run August 9th. In late August, the investigator auditor sought to have an immediate suspension and receivership created for the firm. After consultation with the agency's assistant attorney general, the decision was made to move for a revocation at the earliest possible time instead. The reasoning was that an immediate suspension would not affect the licensee's ability to write checks on the account if she was intent on doing so. In fact, I can show you another case where exactly that happened. And it would take some time to get a receiver appointed through the courts. We got to the point of posting a notice of intent to revoke, at which time the licensee signed the agreed order in mid-October. We later received word that she had continued to make payments to at least some owners, and that some owners had pursued her in the courts. This individual reputedly is in California. The license revocation order has been entered into the Arello database. California uses this database, I'm told. Therefore, that information is available to them should she choose to pursue a license there. Other cases where we've been successful in gaining criminal prosecution are Prineville. Based on an audit, the agency and the licensee entered into a stipulated order requiring him to make regular payments to the CTA and eventually surrender his property management or license. The order found a shortage as large as $80,000, with the licensee making an initial repayment of $18,099. Licensee continued to make payments in of 2000 and reports to the agency through 2000 and 2001. The order was modified in 2002 to revoke his license December 31st, 2002. I believe criminal prosecution was brought against his bookkeeper. Bend, based upon a complaint, an investigation revealed a shortage of some $120,000. The agency sent notice of intention to revoke her property manager license and eventually did so by a stipulated order effective May 1, 2002. Agency also cooperated with the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office in a criminal prosecution resulting in the licensee's pleading guilty to Theft 1 charges. Her husband also appears to be involved, and though criminal charges were not brought against him, he's scheduled for an administrative hearing this summer proposing to revoke his license. McMinnville, these stipulated orders in late 1998 and early 1999 were based on findings that there were shorties in the CTA and that the broker contributed some $28,000 in her own funds to rectify the problem. Broker was reprimanded, her guilty licensee's real estate license was revoked, and another licensee's license was revoked with issuance of a limited salesperson's license. The guilty licensee was prosecuted criminally, and the stipulated revocation was part of her plea bargain. While I'm sure in the past there have been additional successful prosecutions, I'm not aware of any other since I've been commissioner. White collar crime is not usually a top agenda item for district attorneys. Ms. Cedar Leaf made some additional comments in her oral testimony that aren't mentioned in her written testimony I'd like to address. She said, I had a meeting with the commissioner but left the meeting feeling very frustrated. In January, we met with Ms. Cedar Leaf at length and followed up on her suggestions, such as consideration of mentioning DBAs and orders, which in fact we have incorporated. We also encouraged her to submit information so that we could address her concerns. Ms. Cedar Leaf was invited to propose a rule regarding handling interest on clients' trust accounts. We would be prepared to objectively address it. She has not followed up. We strongly encouraged her to offer a course on property management. She said she would do so using agency staff as presented for the course. We have not yet received the course. Commissioner invited Ms. Cedar Leaf to submit information regarding unlicensed practice by regional property management companies. She has not done so. We urged her to work with other industry groups, the ones previously mentioned, in proposing revisions to the laws and rules. She hasn't participated in any coalition efforts in submitting proposals to the agency that I'm aware of. Ms. Cedar Leaf, the agency's website is inadequate for finding information regarding property managers. Information on the agency's website is organized by functional area, that is, education, licensing and renewal, statute and rules, etc., and not by specialty. The information regarding property managers is found within each area. Navigation of the website would be extremely cumbersome if it were organized by specialty. I realize much of what I have said there could be categorized as he said, she said. I have attempted, where possible, to provide you with data to substantiate my remarks, and I would answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Commissioner Taylor?
Senator Morse. Thank you. Who audits the property trust accounts? Is there a standard procedure that is implemented? Sampling?
Senator George, Senator Morse. The agency does periodic client compliance reviews, and the investigator slash auditor that performs that review follows a standard audit checklist, which includes client's trust account audit. And what we're looking for is, do they have their trust account set up properly? Do they reconcile it as the rule requires? Are there balances? Do they reconcile? That sort of thing. Those are accomplished in two manners. First, I would like to say that I think one of my auditors could probably walk into any property management office in Oregon and find compliance problems. It seems to be endemic with the industry. However, we do compliance reviews I mentioned in there that somewhere we had a goal for the number of client compliance reviews we do per quarter. Additionally, anytime we receive a complaint on a property manager, the first thing we do is audit that trust account. That's generally the issue, is missing money. Chair, Senator Morris. Oregon's regulation of property managers is one of the most stringent in the country. In fact, if you look at many states, as I said before, in Oregon previously, real estate brokers did property management, and they were the only ones that could do it. Throughout the country, that's generally the case. I can comment to this extent that most states' rules that I'm aware of's rules are not nearly as stringent as ours. It's still a problem. We cannot regulate against dishonesty. If you can show me a way to do that, I'm more than happy to do it. I will say this. Most of the problems that we see have been experienced with what I would call very small organizations. We don't seem to see the same problem with the larger organizations. Chair, could I follow up?
Oh, certainly.
I mentioned the two bills that we'd submitted, Senate Bill 206 and 208. The trust account overdraft program was primarily headed towards addressing this problem. As I mentioned, if we can get early warning that someone's trust account's overdrawn, we could get in there and hopefully stop the bleeding before it reaches some of the numbers that you've heard. As I said, we had to amend it out to move the bill. We also had proposed for bonding. The bonding, theoretically, could have driven some of the small managers out of business. I'm a small businessman by profession, and I don't like to affect and drive people out of business because of excessive regulation. However, when the public is suffering some of the losses that we see, I'm not so sure that maybe that might not be a bad idea. However, to put it into perspective, there's literally billions of dollars go through clients' trust accounts in Oregon every year, and the best number we could come up with for losses over the last couple of years has been $1.3 million. So though those numbers, if you happen to be the victim, are large, and if you take a look at the number as a whole, it is not large.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to express my approval of the fact that we got a response back, something this detailed in 24 hours on some pretty complex issues that are, like you said, you could argue one way or the other about the appropriateness or what an agency might do, because some of these things we've asked for, we've only got it in our office 2 to 3 days after the hearings on that agency are completely done. So somebody has done some work between yesterday around this time and now. At least we've got something here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, if I might, one, I'd like to compliment my deputy who is sitting somewhere behind me. She and I worked individually on different parts of this bill in remote locations from each other, communicating by email and utilizing the facilities of our database. And frankly, if we didn't have that database functioning at the ability that it does, we wouldn't be here today with this.
Thank you very much. Any further questions for Commissioner Taylor? Yes.
Just in reflection, the banking industry is huge, and it's a trust, obviously, relationship. If we have the state of Oregon, $1.3 million per year in defaults, trusts, or abuse within the banking industry, but the trillions of dollars that go through that, there'd be a hue and cry that wouldn't end in terms of addressing it. And $1.3 million is a lot in my book. misplaced trust and criminal activity.
Chair, Senator Morris, I agree with you. Again, I have to go back to Senate Bill 206. One of the prime opponents of that particular portion of the bill happened to be a financial institution. I'm told that when the bar made this proposal several years ago, they were opposed by the Oregon Bankers Association. And it has to do with the difficulty they encounter apparently internally in providing this information. I agree. As far as I'm concerned, $1 is too much. I've run clients' trust accounts. I've been involved in three real estate companies in my career. Two of those did property management. We had clients' trust accounts for our brokerage activity as well as clients' trust accounts for the property management activities, and I don't remember them ever being out of balance. It's not rocket science.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we have some folks signed up to talk to address in the public hearing, Senate Bill 5541. The first one signed up is Luke Britton. Come on up. Pull up a seat at your convenience. Pull the mic near you and give us your name for the record and then proceed.
This is a new experience for me, so excuse me if I'm follow proper formalities.
You're the new flag.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here and your personal sacrifice that you spend time here to help with these issues. My name is Luke Britton. I'm a general contractor and a residential rental property owner, Salem, Kaiser, Polk County. I've got copies here of testimony.
I'm
going
to ask you because we had...
Certainly.
You had written testimony.
I had some dealings with the Real Estate Commission. We just finished some new apartments in West Salem, and that would be too much for us to manage those. We manage, my wife and I manage our other rental properties. And we had met Dorinda Creel, who's a licensed real estate agent at a few of the educational seminars around the valley here. And she had seemed like she, well, being licensed, we assumed that, and at the educational seminars, that she would be a good candidate to manage those properties. My main concern at that point was finding a reputable on-site manager because they handle the cash and money that comes in. And that was my major concern, was that there is where monies could disappear easily. And it didn't even occur to me that it would be a licensed real estate agent that I would have the issue with. Before first meeting with her, I called the Real Estate Commission and checked on her, and I talked to John Bowles, an agent there, and he had said, well, there had been a complaint against Ms. Creel about lack of accounting, but yet she was a good manager, said she would be okay. So I had met with her and her son. Actually, it was in probably the first middle of May of 2002, and we discussed what kind of services she offered, and we briefly discussed the fees for that. We didn't enter into a contract, and I didn't find out until later time that it was actually required to have a signed contract before she even started work with me on that. A short period of time after that, she had a fire of mysterious origin in her office. And because I'd been working with her for a short period of time and being a contractor, I was down there with a truck to help her retrieve file cabinets and things that weren't damaged in the fire. It's ironic that my apartment manager there, on-site manager, also worked in her office and had told me, she was Luke, that all of her files had been backed up properly, and she had it at home. But she had used that as her excuse why she couldn't provide documentation of what was going on with the funds. After that fire, she had moved to another real estate firm and was there for a short period of time before they terminated her. There were a lot of discrepancies I was seeing because of my experience with managing our other properties and seeing things that were going on there. We hadn't seen any kind of the accounting was non-existent, completely non-existent. And with the other properties, we always make copies of rent checks, money orders that come in, and those go in our files. And I had told our on-site manager, be sure you do that. Thankfully, that's what she ultimately used to do her accounting. When I fired her, it was probably 90 days after we had entered into this when I had fired her and told the manager, do not forward any more monies to her. And I hear people that are out of state where they don't have that opportunity to be here more hands-on. I'd been down and went down to the real estate agency, filed a report. As I turned to leave there, I seen they had some of the real estate journals there, and I picked those up for reading. I got out to my pickup and opened that up, and as I'm reading through this, the April 29th reprimand for Dorinda Creel was in that issue. That was 2 weeks prior to when I just met with her the first time, and that reprimand was for not having a signed rental or contract with property owners. So it's not like it was an error on her part. It's just blatant the way that she'd done some of these things. So when I talked to Sharon Woods there when I filed that report, and Ms. Woods was extremely professional and helpful with that. I'd gotten a copy of some information there to help me compile my things, and I went immediately and filed the small claims against Dorinda Creel. There were a lot of other people that were having problems, the same type of problems, and I wasn't aware of this until after I'd entered into this with them. I'd waited, hadn't heard back from the agency on what was going on with this, and when I'd called in, the report had been turned in, but the agency wasn't going to pursue this because there were already reports, complaints against her, that I would have to file a civil suit against her, and that I'd called and left messages for Mr. Mosley. I want to find out why the agency wasn't trying to protect me from what was going on. And this is not, the rents for a project like that are about $32,000 to $33,000 a month. In 3 months' time, you're close to $100,000 that this person is taking with no accounting whatsoever done yet of the money that's taken. Now, this is something that could bankrupt you in no time and lose a $3 million property because of this. Ultimately learned that the Dorinda Creel, her license was going to be voluntarily revoked, and that she admitted to no wrongdoing. And with no assistance from the agency in retrieving any of my funds like that, I had went ahead and pursued filing a small claims court action. I'd heard that she was leaving the state, had her personal home for sale, and with the help from Emily Cedarleaf, I was able to get a lien on her home because Emily had discovered where she had used funds from the company for personal use, and because of that, it pierced the corporate veil so that we were able to get a legal lien on her property. When this came up to court, I'd given a subpoena to Sharon Woods, and she had said she would be happy to come testify for me on this. When she came, she brought, it looked like an airline carry-on luggage handle on wheels, bringing that file from Ms. Creel. It was huge. And Dorinda Creel had came up from California to defend herself, and of course the rest of the world was wrong. Everybody's wrong was on this, but her. And through the testimony, it was almost like it was going to be a draw, or I would lose with this. And when Sharon Woods testified and the judge asked a few questions, I could just see the veil over his face just change, that it was clear that Dorinda Creel had done a lot of errors, and the way that she had conducted business was not right. And that was a real turning point in my case. And the judge found for us, and we recovered some of the monies with that. But since I had filed that small claims, along the way we kept discovering more and more money that was missing. But it was too late to go back and try to update that. And during that time, I had bills come in from other agencies that had done credit reports, advertising, that my response to them was, the Statesman Journal, if that advertising was for those apartments, I paid her, but I will pay you because that was for my apartments, the right thing, and I will try to square up with her. And I did recover some of my funds, but I really don't have any idea how much is still missing. Her idea of showing me that bills had been paid was to print, do a computer screen printout of her check register. And I said, well, I would like to see a copy of a canceled check that you paid that account. Well, this is it, and I can't get it. The bank can't get that record. Well, she banks at Key Bank. I went there and personally checked. They said, 24 hours, we can have you copy. No problem. And so after this case, I called Sharon Woods to thank her for her help, because there was no way I could have won that without her being there. I had found out that she had been reprimanded for this, for not running it through her supervisor, and that they would have quashed the subpoena had they have known about it in advance. And that was crucial to me winning that case. I kind of felt, sitting in the back of this room, like I was in the wrong room, because I was quite frankly impressed with the big guns they have at the real estate agency, but and the midnight oil that they must have burned last night getting their response together, because I didn't see any of that effort. The only person that I had met with was Sharon Woods, and I have to say that she was outstanding in her help with solving my problems with this. And there was another individual, grass seed farmer down in the Southern Valley, that was hurt by this Dorinda Creel as well. And I had them come up to my home and help them to fill out their small claims paperwork to get a lien on her home, because she was trying to close quickly to get out of town. They were the only other ones that recovered any money from this. And I almost had like survivor's remorse. I asked my wife, I said, well, you know what, we're the only ones that recovered any money from this. And I've heard that there's been people that have been forced into bankruptcy because of her conduct. And it was with blatant disregard for the law. And to find out that she signed an agreement that admitting to no wrongdoing, that there wasn't enough evidence, it's just so far out of my realm to understand this. I don't understand why she was allowed to remain in business like this. Just thankfully I was in town, had enough knowledge of the rental business, and kept seeing all these red flags pop up that I'd done the intervention. Some of the people that might be out of town might not be able to show up on site and tell the manager, do not forward any more funds to this person, because that manager was ultimately my employee. And I made that clear from the beginning that I didn't want her to be an employee of the management company, because I was fearful of losing that control. And thankfully, I didn't. But there's other people that are out of state that, you know, this was their livelihood or their retirement money that's been taken from them. I'd asked Emily, she's just been the rock of Gibraltar to help over the years. That's probably been 10 years that I've been involved in. residential rentals, you know, why they didn't stop her when they knew that this stuff was going on. She was able to find a lot of the information that I used in my court case. I just don't know. I'm just overwhelmed with this. I tell you, to come in here and sit back there and listen to this, I just thought, I truthfully felt I was in the wrong room.
Mr. Brittle, let me ask you a question.
Please.
I think you were seated when we had the performance measures,
mm-hmm.
and the number one thing, the first goal, I'm actually reading it, the
yes.
first goal is to provide quality protection for Oregon consumers of real estate-related services.
Yes, sir.
And your response is?
I was making some notes during that, and, you know, to be trustworthy, consumer protection, and I felt no protection there. I felt like when I went there, like I say, Sharon Woods was outstanding with her help with that, above and beyond. I deal with city, county, state, with the construction end of it, and you'll see a difference there. And the professional standards, she was everything I would expect and appreciate. And beyond that, I seen no effort, no help there. I would have liked to have seen criminal prosecution against this woman for what she'd done, because it was with complete blatant disregard. And like Mr. Taylor said, you can go in any office and probably find some discrepancies. And I don't see that you need to be iron-fisted with, you know, small problems, you know, if it was unintended. But this was blatant, and the woman was a complete con. I certainly appreciate an opportunity to come here, and I feel like when this was done, and like I say, with the conversation with my wife, that I felt like I'd had survivor's remorse. That why were we the only ones that came out of this somewhat whole? I feared this was just done, and hopefully I felt at that point that I would never have to go through this again with the real estate agency, because it just wasn't, especially after finding out that the subpoena would have been quashed.
Any questions for Mr. Britton? Representative Krieger.
Maybe not necessarily a question, but I'd like to have some information provided by the agency as to the total dollars involved in these other cases of misconduct, so we already know the impact that she's had on people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a response also on the basis of why this was not more aggressively pursued, particularly since you were informing them of other problems you
yes.
were aware of.
Yes. I'm eager for the information as well.
Okay. We'll make sure we get a response for you.
I greatly appreciate it.
Senator Morris.
This whole issue is, in my opinion, it's not a personality-driven issue. It's not an attack on a person issue. It's a policy issue, and how do we address the policy? And if what I'm hearing today is correct, we have a major problem. We're letting people down. The bills are referred to 206 and 208. I assume those are in previous sessions, not this one. This session?
This session.
Somebody isn't understanding the picture, or is understanding it differently than I am. I guess it would maybe be helpful to understand the number of trust accounts, the actual fraud that has occurred, if it is of the magnitude that has been represented by the director. I can't imagine these bills dying. There's an issue here that needs to be looked at, and our respective caucuses to mm-hmm. talk about it, and it's not too late to go back and work these bills.
That's exactly right. We're relatively early into the process.
Yeah.
Well, my comment is we have a profession. It's a regulated profession. The assumption is of the goals that we're going to protect the consumer. And, my thinking is very seriously we need to have a total explanation of how many of these things get reported that aren't acted upon and those sort of things. I think that would be informative for you and also for us.
Well, sir, as being a licensed general contractor with the Construction Contractors Board, that if I fail to perform on a project, that it's my hide on the wall. And I'm fully aware of that and accept that. Mm-hmm. And it helps me to perform, you know, that there are consequences for that. And, you know, like when I went into this, my greatest fear was the on-site manager handling the cash. I didn't realize it was the person holding the bank that would be my biggest downfall there. So, and just not knowing that.
Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an editorial comment. I certainly agree with Senator Morris that moving those other two bills could be critical to improving this whole situation. And I'll probably sound like a broken record over the next few weeks, but one of the bigger problems I see, and I sit on the public safety Ways and Means Subcommittee, with the cuts that we're looking at in public safety, reduction of the court budget, reduction of district attorneys, reduction of law enforcement.
I have the same thought.
You know, we can improve the situation with those two bills, but I'd be very fearful in terms of the next biennium whether the resources will be there to protect the public at all. We're looking at civil cases being delayed, you know, incredibly. Maybe getting to a 4 to 6 year delay in civil cases through the judiciary, which in a situation like this could be just devastating to a small property owner or a small business person. The cuts to DA staff, I mean, we already have a problem in terms of being prosecution on white collar crime. I mean, it's not terribly relative to what we're talking about here today in terms of specifics, but the whole climate of how the state's going to be conducting commercial business is going to be just devastating if we aren't able to fully fund the judiciary and some of the investigators and people on the criminal side to work matters like this. And I think this is the example of how serious some of those things can be affecting a property owner or a small business person. End of editorial.
Representative, I had the exact same thought relative to the committee we sit on the afternoon, which is, in fact, public safety. And then I went back to look, you know, on page 5 of the written response, and the agency proposed Senate Bill 208, which is establishes a bonding provision, which would have been needed protection if, in fact, we cannot prosecute because of, you know, a system that is not functioning up to its proper speed. The only thing you have then is protection of knowing that, in fact, some bonding agency may step up to it. We need to, Senator Morris, you had a look on your face like you'd like to ask a question or make a comment?
I'll defer in the interest of time.
Okay, because we need to get Andrea up here, too.
I would just like, with the attempt to quash the subpoena, I had paid for the subpoena and was pursuing it on my own time and expense, and that the real estate would not even support that, which I don't see as being a major expense to them. But not to have that support there is not would not have been an expense to them, but was imperative to me winning that case. And, you know, especially with the budget constraints, so the courthouse is now closed on Fridays and length of it. But
well, I'm going to ask right now, we're running short on time.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you and Eleanor, though, to give us all the information you can, and we'll try to get answers for this. Because, I mean, I think it represents a problem that better be addressed.
Yes, sir.
Because that's amazing that we're over $1 million. And it may be greater than that if, in fact, some of these people never even were heard as to what their potential losses were.
Went away. Yeah, I agree with the comment that the baking industry is regulated, that it's down to the nickel. And this is, yeah, so we should be able to. I'd be happy to help that.
Just one very quick comment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. I don't think we need to depend on the judiciary. I think if this bill was crafted correctly, you could have a provision to access that bond through this agency, write the rules, and that those bond funds could be released based on the findings and avoid the judiciary. So I'm upset. that this nothing's being done on that.
My concern would be the time of that because of the mortgage payment that I personally faced that, you know, I could be bankrupt before that money, those funds came through.
And you were accepting the fact that this was a licensed person you were trusting.
Yes.
Very important issue,
yes.
Right there.
Yes.
You were assuming a professional,
yes,
was there. Could we get Andrea up here? And Luke, if you wouldn't mind, would you just stay right there?
Oh, certainly.
Come on up and have a little interaction here. I think we need to get to the bottom of this.
Certainly.
George, members of the committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to appear in front of you today. For the record, my name is Andrea Bushnell. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I did not originally sign up to testify yesterday. I didn't think that there would be a need for me to testify on this bill. However, after hearing the testimony yesterday, I felt that our association probably at least needed to be heard and to respond to some of the at least implied allegations that were made yesterday. So I'm here to do that today. The Oregon Association of Realtors is an association, a nonprofit association, representing over 13,000 members, all realtor members in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Real Estate Agency, on the other hand, is the licensing agency responsible for licensing the real estate professionals, which include our members, real estate brokers, property managers, and escrow companies as well. Like other licensing agencies, the Oregon Real Estate Agency has a very delicate role to play, if you will, in a balancing act between assisting the regulated industry, which includes my members, to make certain the public in general benefits from the availability of high-quality professional services, and protecting individual consumers by taking appropriate licensing actions against individuals who do not meet the statutory obligations imposed on real estate licensees. The obligations that are actually imposed on licensees are not established by the real estate agency. They are established by the legislature. Those duties, which we refer to as the fiduciary duties, are set out in ORS 696.805-815. They are, as they should be, the law of the state. It's then the agency's job and obligation to take licensing action against licensees who cannot or will not conform their conduct to that demanded by the legislature. The real estate agency's duties and responsibilities, or its mission, we've talked about the real estate agency's mission in the last couple of days. When it comes to disciplining real estate licensees, which include my members, are set out in ORS 696.301. ORS 696.015, which was referred to yesterday, contains the legislative findings that explain why the legislature created a real estate agency and granted it disciplinary powers under ORS 696.301. The commissioner also has the statutory authority to ask the attorney general to assist the commissioner in having a court-appointed receiver in cases where licensees have commingled trust funds or embezzled trust funds, which we've talked quite a bit about today, but only if the activity is likely to cause significant financial loss to others. Typically, if the money's already gone or if it's otherwise been accounted for, there's no purpose served by actually having exercising the judicial remedy of receivership. In those cases, it's really much more expedient to prevent future harm by taking disciplinary action directly against the licensees, which in this case would, from my experience, would always be a revocation in an embezzlement case. Our association supports the strict enforcement of real estate laws. Our members demand that the agency use disciplinary authority appropriately to maintain the highest degree of professionalism in the industry. We understand that the agency is faced with no small task. Our association is, in fact, more than willing to assist in this effort. Our members no more want a bad actor within our ranks than any profession does. In the Dearborn case that you have heard so much about in the last couple of days, when I go out and talk to my members about appellate decisions that have come down regarding the real estate industry, both in our state and nationwide, I talk about the Dearborn case, and I give the facts of the Dearborn case, and my members are absolutely appalled that this person was allowed to stay in the industry through the actions of the courts. At the same time, our association has actually filed an amicus brief in the Curley matter, which is a follow-up to the Dearborn case, because we felt that there was a need to clarify the appeals court opinion that a bad act had to be conducted when the licensee is actually engaged in the real estate, practiced real estate. And we're saying, no, that isn't true, that Dearborn was misapplied in that regard. Dearborn held there had to be a nexus between the Real Estate Act and the bad acts. Curley went one step further and said, no, you have to actually be active in the real estate practice at the time of the bad act. And we've actually appeared in that matter because we don't want that standard to exist. If a bad act has occurred, if someone has embezzled funds in another life, if you will, you know, should they then be allowed to have a real estate license and be handling other people's money? And we don't think that that's appropriate. At the same time, there was some implication that perhaps the agency exists for the protection of licensees. And I have to tell you that our association has for some time been concerned about agency investigative processes and procedures. That concern is based on a growing awareness of inconsistent outcomes in discipline cases. Some cases seem to result in very little action when the bad act seems egregious. Others, which result in suspensions or even revocations for what look like innocent mistakes. Do you have a problem with that as well?
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Are the investigations held in confidence, or are they open to the public?
The investigations are not open to the public. They are held in confidence. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Well, I read that in here, and then you stated that. How does your organization determine that certain acts are egregious and others are not when the investigations are held in confidence?
Chair George, Representative Smith, we don't know about these when the investigations are proceeding unless our members come to us and tell us about what they're going through with the agency. Otherwise, we find out about what has happened in these investigations and the ultimate sanctions after the fact when the matter does become one of public record.
Just so I understand.
Certainly.
So then when the final decision is made, all the facts then associated with the final decision become public record?
Chair George, Representative Smith, I'm hesitating there for a minute because I don't actually ever go in and look at the entire file. Although on occasion our members will provide their file to us and we will review the entire file that our members have provided to us. I have not gone to the agency to receive that file. I think that there... Oh, excuse me.
And we're going to have to ask you, we have your written testimony, if you could move
Yep, I'll it. Move forward there. It's just a few things that I particularly want to stress today. I do think that the agency has been dealing with some problems of late. They have a turnover in executive staff. They have some ongoing personnel problems. They have a lack of adequate internal investigative policies and procedures. We have expressed those concerns to the agency. I can assure you that my conversations with Commissioner Taylor are not always pleasant. Notwithstanding that, rather than taking a budgetary pot shot at this agency, our association is committed to working with the agency to see that these problems are resolved. And we have found the agency to be very receptive to resolving the problems that we bring to them. They're receptive to solutions. They address our concerns. But it's important to keep working. An example is the agency called a task force fairly recently to resolve some ongoing problems that our association had identified. We had a meeting. There were representatives from our association. There were representatives of the board. commissioner, his employees. We came out of that meeting, again, feeling like perhaps we had a little bit better understanding of the agency, but not entirely satisfied. But you don't quit the discussion. You go back and you try again, and you bring suggestions to the table and see what works. And that's what we've done. And in the years that I have been working with the agency, I have found that Commissioner Taylor, despite the fact that we don't always agree, is a very credible, honest man. I trust him, and I hope that you will not take budgetary action against this agency. I do think that there are some problems that need to be resolved. I do agree with that. But we do respectfully request that you support this legislation, approve the agency's budget, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Andrew, it's going to be at least my desire on behalf of the committee to get information, any information we can get on this, and it won't be a budgetary potshot. I mean, we're looking for reform. If we have a big problem here, we want this dealt with. And, I mean, I've seen things go on and on and on forever and ever and ever, and I'm, as I said to somebody the other day, I'm right up to here.
Right.
And when we start off by saying that our goal is to protect the consumers of the state of Oregon, then that's going to be our goal. Okay? And so any information we receive from anyone, from Luke or Emily or anyone else out there that may be listening to us today, I would like to have that in our hand that the committee can look at it. And then we will possibly be considering our support for some legislation if necessary. What is your position on 208?
We have taken no position on 208. We've been neutral on it. We do support 206. We've taken a position on 206, but we've remained neutral on 208. So, excuse me, Chair George, I didn't mean to insinuate that this body was taking a budgetary potshot.
It's okay.
That wasn't my intent.
Yeah, we just all of a sudden got pretty serious about the issue after hearing Luke. So it's,
and our association agrees. We want to see these people dealt with. It's better for our industry, and we support that.
That's exactly right. It's an industry based upon trust. That's why we pay the fees.
That's right.
Very good. Without further, we need to get to the floor, and so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5541, Real Estate Agency, and tap the gavel. We adjourn. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.